this is Lewis.
And this is Ian.
And welcome to another 100 films you should have seen, probably.
How am I supposed to say probably? I thought you say 101 movies.
Let's break the routine.
Probably.
Probably.
Welcome to...
Dark City. This is the next podcast.
Good call. You see, the reason why I hesitated there, dear listener, is that we've recorded a couple of podcasts before this, and we've sometimes recorded them out of sequence. And what we've had to do is go back, re-edit it, and place in, change the where we say this is the fifth or fourth or third. So we're not going to do that anymore. We're going to try not to do that to give ourselves a little bit of flexibility.
It's just causing a headache.
Oh, it's a nightmare. I tell you what, I don't know if you found this, Liz, but since doing this podcast, I've got so much more respect and admiration for people who do really good podcasts. And the editing and the way they kind of put in little sound effects and little kind of stings. Yeah. I find it amazing. Now, listening, I find it so... I mean, admittedly, we are trying to do it on a free program we've downloaded on the internet, but even so.
Yeah, oh, it's a little of work. I hope you appreciate this.
Yeah.
It really is
quite
a lot of work.
Yeah, all you lot at home. Yeah.
You think it's just talking into a microphone.
Yeah, well, yeah.
It is, basically, but yeah.
So, Dark City.
Dark City, yes.
1998's Dark City.
Yeah. It's a good film.
Good, right? And that's all.
And that's it, yeah. Yeah, no, Dark City is a really good film.
So, it's your film.
It's my recommendation.
I hadn't seen it before.
Okay. I'll explain why I chose this one. Basically, I watched this on a late night showing on BBC Two or something several years ago.
Okay, paint a picture.
Painting a picture, yeah. I was there in my room alone.
Right, okay. So this is when you were living in Leighton? Or when you lived at home?
I think it might... I can't remember exactly where it was, but I remember...
Bit drunk, Lewis?
Bit drunk, came back, turned
tired,
on the telly.
A bit emotional.
Bit tired. And and turned on the
this
film.
This is the Lewis of the early 20s. He was not in a good place in the early
20s. Bit tired, bit emotional. Turned on the telly.
Still.
Okay, let's just talk about the film. Yeah?
Okay.
So I turned on the telly and it had already started. I think it was about 15 minutes in or something. And so I just watch this, whatever.
Yeah.
And
such a Lewis at 22 attitude. Carry on.
I've matured.
Yes, it definitely has.
Anyway, so I thought, I'll watch this. And it really sucked me in. I thought it was it's a really interesting film visually. It's completely different from anything I'd seen before.
We'll talk a lot about that
later
in the podcast. But really striking. I can totally understand if you just flicked it on TV and you were channel surfing, why you would stay watching this.
Yeah.
Incredibly visually interesting and unusual. Mm. Directed by, what's his name? Alex Proyas, how would you
Alex
pronounce?
Proyas,
who also directed The Crow.
Mm-hmm.
It has a similar look to it, I guess.
Yeah.
Kind of lots of darkness and shadows and...
He likes his dark. Nice slab of dark.
Nice slab of dark. He does seem to enjoy that.
Watching the film, there was one scene in particular at the end that really, really struck me, which I'm not going to talk about because it's kind of a bit of a big giveaway. It really, really stuck with me. And interestingly, we were talking about the ending. And funnily enough, I completely forgotten about the ending until I watched it a second time.
Really?
Bizarrely.
Oh, okay.
Bizarrely. But we won't get into that. But it really stayed with me. And I never saw the film again. Until I watched it again to do this podcast. But the imagery of the film really stayed in my mind.
So you only saw the very first 15 minutes?
I didn't see the 15 minutes.
I mean, but that's what I mean. For the first time you saw the first 15 minutes.
Is this
this time,
time
when
watched
you watched
it, yeah.
It. Okay. Before, we should explain really, listener. Before we started to record this, we had a long discussion about how much detail we should give away about the plot. Now... The reason why is because it's a really interesting and unusual plot. There's a kind of a lot of mystery, but at the behest of the studio at the time, they did a Blade Runner. They forced them to give it a voiceover at the beginning of the film, which essentially explains the entire film, gives away every twist in the first 30 seconds or so.
Yeah.
Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, they were worried that the viewers wouldn't understand what was going on, so they thought they'd just tell them exactly what happens.
And Once I watched it, I then read up about the film, and a few people recommend actually turning the sound down for the first 10 seconds. It opens on a kind of starscape, and you just see space, don't you?
Yeah.
And then eventually the kind of camera pans, and you see Kiefer Sutherland's character on a telephone. And people recommend having the sound off until you see Kiefer Sutherland appear, then turning the sound up, and then watching the film then. I mean, it would have been such a different experience.
Yes.
Not knowing certain knowledge. So I think we're going to be very careful about how we tell the plot, because we don't want to give the whole kind of voiceover version of the plot, but we will need to obviously explain a little bit about what happens. So essentially, the film is about a man.
How general are we going to be about this?
A man in a house.
No. And there's a woman.
like a
man and a woman and another man.
My godson describes Home Alone as the boy in the house. Which I think is a great description.
Great idea for a podcast, describing films in one line.
The boy in the house. So anyway, a man wakes up in a bathroom. Kind of a slightly run-down, seedy motel, hotel-style bathroom with no memory of why he's there or who he is.
Why is he turning into Dracula again?
The way Lewis is looking at me there, I felt I had to add a... he then spends the next big chunk of the film trying to piece together his life, work out who he is, what he's capable of, what he's running from, why he's in this situation, and all the way through that he's being chased by some mysterious black hatted and black trench coat scary people. Is that right?
Black trench coat scary people. I believe that's what they're listed are.
And these black hatted trench coat people have the scary people have the ability to control reality itself. They can manipulate reality using psychic powers.
This is great.
Why am I doing these voices?
I don't know. Just keep going. This is brilliant. I can listen to this all day.
I've already got Lewis hooked.
Exactly.
He's seen the film. He's like, this is amazing.
It's not the film I saw.
They also have the ability to move people's memories around as well and change people's memories.
Yeah.
So I suppose it's... it kind of riffs on that feeling that some of us perhaps have, or lots of crazy people have, but occasionally we all sort of have moments where we think, ooh, what kind of world, what is this world? You know, is someone else secretly running it or controlling it or being buffeted by things outside our control, not really knowing who's pulling all the levers, calling the shots? And it really emphasises that by having them in black trench coats and black hats scarily chasing around, and also one of them played by the great Richard O'Brien.
Richard O'Brien. I'm actually going to stand up.
I thought you were going to get a mouth organ out from the Crystal Maze. He's standing up there listening. No, he's sat back down. We should probably sing the New Zealand national anthem.
Is he?
No, he moved there when very young, grew up in New Zealand. But he's not a New Zealand national. I think he wants to retire there, and they're sorting out some kind of special one-off case giving him nationality there.
It's called the Richard O'Brien Act.
Yes, it is. All he has to do is they're going to put him in a large crystal dome, and they're going to he has to collect 100 gold visas.
Oh, how I wish.
Little reference there to the crystal. I wonder if we have any international listeners who will have no idea what
no
that was about.
No idea.
Look on YouTube, Crystal Maze.
Crystal Maze, the best program ever made.
Apparently it was voted, I read this on Wikipedia when I was looking up Richard O'Brien, apparently it was voted the best quiz show ever in 2003 on some challenge TV or something like
it's
that.
It's not actually a quiz show though, is it?
It is. You're right, it isn't a quiz show, there are no... Well, you've got a mentor, sometimes they ask questions. Mumsy used to ask questions.
Mumsy.
She asked questions, didn't she?
Well, technically, it's a game show. It's not a quiz
show. It's a game show. Oh, yeah, maybe that was it. It was a game show, not a quiz show. I guess a game show.
It would be a really easy quiz show.
It would be a very easy... Well, I don't know. Some of those questions Mumsy used to ask were a little bit tricky. Yeah.
Okay, now you've got 10 seconds to make a cup of tea. Go!
Oh, that's an old... What's that? It's a sketch from the Mary Whitehouse
Experience.
Wow, we're all referencing all sorts of 90s TV shows here in today's podcast. Anyway, so getting back on topic to Dark City. We've mentioned Richard Brom. We should probably run through the other actors and characters in it. So we've got, as I said, the man, John Murdoch, is played by Rufus, how do you pronounce his name?
Rufus Sewell.
Sewell? I just think of it as Brian Sewell.
Sewell.
Isn't it Brian Sewell?
Sewell.
We have William Hurt playing an Inspector Frank Bumstead.
Oh, he's good, isn't he?
He is very good, isn't he? He's good. And his name's Bumstead.
He's Bumstead, isn't he? Bumstead.
I'm going to call him Bumstead. Kiefer Sutherland, in a very unusual, playing a kind of slightly weird sort of Germanic sometimes.
I love
not, not Germanic all the time.
I've got this theory about Kiefer Sutherland in this film.
Psychiatrist.
It's weird. He does this. He's basically this mad scientist. Yeah. He speaks like this.
It's very much like that.
And
you've got to understand, John, that I can't explain. Yeah, it's very. He has a very odd delivery.
Listen to me.
It's very odd. He's not the Elephant Man. That sounds
sounds like, I tell you.
He's not doing an impression of the Elephant Man.
But yeah, I've got this theory that Kiefer Sutherland, he kind of went to the audition and, you know, Alex Proyas is like, okay, so he's kind of a mad doctor character. Can you do kind of a mad doctor voice? And Kiefer Sutherland's thinking, well, I'll just go really over the top and do this voice. Yeah, I'll try this one. Yes, and this is my voice. And Alex is like, yes, perfect, do that. And Kiefer's like, oh God, I've got to do this for the whole film.
Well, he plays Dr. Daniel P. Schreiber.
Schreiber?
I can't remember.
You only watched it the other day.
I know. John Murdoch's wife is played by the lovely Jennifer Connelly.
Blank-faced Jennifer Connelly.
She's very blank-faced in this, but she's not normally blank-faced. Not that much. She's particularly blank-faced in this one.
She's very blank. She's always blank-faced.
She's not blank-faced in Labyrinth.
Oh, Labyrinth. That was her peak.
Her first major film was her peak. we've already mentioned Richard O'Brien, who plays... can't do that every single time. The podcast will last forever, and we're determined to keep it. We've noticed our last few podcasts have been a little bit long, so we're trying to keep.
Make
them longer. People love them when they're longer.
Exactly, they love it when their downloads take about 10 hours. 20,
yeah, Richard Brown playing kind of, I suppose, the main villain in the piece. The kind of we're about to mention Ian Richardson, who plays the kind of the leader of the villains, but I mean. He's not
grumpy-faced Ian Richardson.
And I was like, I know you. And then I just couldn't think of who it was. And then once I looked, after the film ended, looked him up, I was like, of course, Ian Richardson, of course. Great British actor. Sadly, no longer with us. It's very sad, isn't it?
It's very sad.
I think it's a great cast, actually.
Yeah, it's
and
fantastic.
They use them all very well. I mean... I was trying to think, all the other characters very much are extras. You've got these kind of core characters who are really used well, got a lot of screen time. And outside of those, everyone else really just feel like...
There's a lot of black trench coat scary people in there.
Yes, we've got there's the other kind of... Richard O'Brien's, I suppose, henchmen or psychics.
Yeah.
We've got kind of one really, really tall person.
Yeah.
Richard O'Brien's character is called Mr. Hand.
Yeah, they're all called
Ian Richardson played the leader, Mr. Book.
Mr. Book.
So it's all very. Even just saying that, you can sort of get an idea of what the tone of the film. You know, like, Mr. Hand, how do you do? Yeah, it's that kind of thing.
Our colleague, Mr. Sleep.
Yeah, exactly. Mr. No Sleep. With us. Yeah, it's that sort of thing. They also have a kind of two twin, or what, like one really small kid. Who's kind of
very creepy child.
You see, we'll talk about that later. But I didn't find him that creepy. I'll talk about that.
You always say this. We'll talk about it now. God damn it.
Well, I would say okay. In it, there's just a child.
is that all? Is that what we're waiting for?
This is why you're delivering teasing. The podcast now. I just say there was a man. There was a child. There was a woman. No, the child playing one. The henchmen. The henchmen all kind of have greyish skin, don't they? Bald heads, grey skin, and so you have this little boy, grey head.
Little boy, wise beyond his years.
Yeah, and he kind of grins, and he's got sharp little teeth, and then he carries a knife. And I could see it was supposed to be creepy.
A kid with a knife and sharp teeth. I mean, that's got.
Oh, it just didn't make me creepy. It just looks a bit silly to me.
Creeped me out.
Oh, well, maybe you got issues.
A little kid with a knife and sharp teeth and a bowler hat came up to me on the tube.
The bowler hat, definitely, definitely, that would freak me. Everything up to that, I'd be like, oh, just another day in London, isn't it, Kit Lewis? The moment he's wearing,
that
a, bowler
kid's wearing
hat.
A bowler hat. Oh god.
So Dark City.
Oh wait. Come on. There's one very important lady that you mentioned.
Oh, Melissa George. Yeah. I wasn't going to put her down as the main thing, but I'm making a note of her simply because she made quite an impression.
I just sat there going, is that girl from Neighbours? And then I realised, I looked it up later, and it's not Neighbours, it's Home and Away.
Yeah, it is, yeah.
Oh, the lovely, lovely angel.
She plays...
she ain't no angel anymore.
Well, she plays a prostitute in this very small, tiny role.
Tiny role, but memorable.
Yes. She makes quite an impression. And a prostitute called May. Yeah.
Is that what you're going to say?
Yeah, well, what can we say? We're talking about the character.
Can we talk about Melissa George more?
Before this, all right, I'm going to just show the back end of this, the workings here. We sat down, we're like, oh, we're all unstructured, our podcast. We've really got to, let's stick to a structure. Let's make a list of what we're going to follow, what we're going to talk about. So I'm going through this list, one by one, bit by bit, explaining it, being clear. And Lewis keeps going, oh, let's jump around, let's mix things up.
Well, you've written down Melissa George, and you don't want to talk about Melissa
George? On the list of characters, Lewis, that I'm going through.
Yeah,
but she was a tiny little role. I was going to bring her in a bit later as a sort of funny little bit about her boobs. Now you've ruined it.
Well, talk about it now. You've written it down.
Anyway.
There's no bit on the list about boobs.
That's in the list in my head.
I mean, pretty much... Why am I meant to know about the list in your head?
Because you know pretty much that always on the list in my head, there's just boobs. That's pretty much all that's on the list in my head. And pretty much anything. So. And we'll just talk about... We'll talk about the characters in a bit. All the characters. I want to talk about...
Fine, whatever.
I want to talk more about the kind of general look and feel of the film.
Yeah, well, you go ahead.
To give some context to talk about the characters. So the whole film is like a kind of set in a sort of a slightly ambiguous city. A city where it's not quite clear what time period it's set in. The closest I, you know, really reminded of, I'm sure it reminded you of, was Tim Burton's Gotham City.
Yes, yeah.
You know, kind of a 50s feel, but has current technology, but really old-fashioned technology.
And slightly wobbly model trains.
Wobbly model trains. Nothing looks quite right. Yeah, there was men wearing Fedora hats, but they also have, like, modern televisions. It's all just slightly off. Yeah, you know, so it has a sort of... sort of 50s look to it generally, I guess. You know, neon lights, kind of 50s diner, American style looks. But then it also has odd bits of architecture or odd buildings that look really out of place.
Yeah, there's kind of Art Deco stuff and kind of more 60s kind of looking things. It's all a bit all over the place. And it's kind of, I suppose it's similar to the Batman kind of Gotham City, just... which is very much kind of a 40s film, but also with lots of very modern kind of parts to it.
Yeah, definitely. I feel it's quite heavily influenced by that anyway. And I must admit, I'm going to hold my hands up here, I've not seen The Crow.
Is that
similar? Is that...
Yes, it has a similar aesthetic. It's very dark, nice slab of dark. And it's very stylized and very much... It does feel quite timeless too, but... very much more modern than this film.
And it's always set at night. Throughout the entire film, it's completely set at night. And it's very kind of, I suppose, noirish feel as well. Yeah. You know, the classic story of someone waking up, losing their memory and having to piece together. So his wife has a touch. She's a nightclub singer, which is, again, a real typical kind of... detective film noir kind of profession for any woman to have. Yeah, that's quite true, isn't it? A prostitute and a nightclub singer.
That's it.
That's a sort of standard profession in a sort of 50s noirish film. That and the waitress. Those are the only three professions.
That's it. There's very limited opportunities for women in
a dead
noir
body.
Films.
That's the other one. That's the only other one. It's seemingly.
Oh, dear.
So it's heavily influenced, but that kind of those kind of films, that kind of setting, yeah. A slightly off period setting.
Yeah, when I was reading around the film, I saw someone compared it to an Edward Hopper painting. I thought that was quite a good comparison.
Yeah, true. Yeah.
Very kind of similar feel to it, kind of emptiness, loneliness, but also that kind of 1940s, 50s kind of style.
That's very true, especially considering a lot of the plot is about characters trying to sort of connect with each other, about what makes us as people. Yeah, definitely. So that is good. Who wrote that? They should be doing this podcast.
Well, basically anyone should be doing it except us. People who know stuff about films and
very
things.
True, yeah. Very true. So we follow John Murdoch, Rufus's character, as he tries to piece together his life. Yeah, he finds odds and ends. He searches his pockets, finds little references, and he kind of builds this picture up of his life. And throughout that, he starts to realise he has special powers.
Special powers,
and I don't feel we're giving too much away there because he's unique.
Special powers,
which is why Richard O'Brien, Mr. Hand, is so interested in him. That's why he's being chased.
You've paused. You've broken down. Quick, wind the key.
We'll just cut that pause out. So that's fine.
Please do it again. We can
cut
just
this.
Speak.
Well, we can cut all this out. Doesn't matter. We'll cut all this bit out.
No, let's not cut this out. Just say something.
Right. I can't think of anything to say.
God. Okay, let me take over. So, what did you think of the film?
I really enjoyed it.
Yeah.
I think we're looking at the kind of feel of it, the sort of ambience or the look of it. I would say this, and maybe you'll sort of understand what I mean here. It looks like a big budget film, but made by the BBC.
Yes.
It has a weird kind of televisual studio bound feel. Now, I think that's done on purpose.
Yeah.
And the whole, I did read that there were no external shots. It's all done in studio.
Yep, yep.
But it really feels like that. So it feels bizarrely cheap.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's visually really interesting and unusual. Yes. But there's a sort of cheapness to it.
Yeah. It's like Sylvester McCoy era Doctor Who.
Bit like that, definitely. Yeah, definitely. If they had a bit more money, it has. I've not seen it, but I kind of imagine Neverwhere to have been in Neil Gaiman TV show, which I've not actually seen.
Yeah,
but when I hear them trying to do, it was just there was a weird offness to it, which I think is probably done on purpose.
Mm.
But it did make me think that the film's older than it actually was. When I kind of watched it, I was like, is this really? And then I was like, wow, 1998?
It's really interesting because it's
1 year before The Matrix. And we'll talk about the...
Just talk about it now.
All right, okay. Well, no, because I was going to say, we'll mention The Matrix in a bit. But the 1 year difference, and there's, it looks so... Cheap is not quite the word, but it looks studio bound is definitely the word.
Yeah, it does.
All the words. It just looks very kind of the lights, the look of the buildings, the streets, all of it.
Well, a lot of it's done with models, and this is the thing. The big difference you notice with kind of modern productions is the huge use of CGI now, which in a way is kind of it's a shame. Because I think you lose some of the immediacy of actually having people performing on real sets. But at the same time, there is kind of this wonkiness about it. I mentioned the wonky model trains. And,
Definitely. I mean, a lot of the model shots
just
look... I mean, without going into too much, revealing too much detail about the plot...
You can really tell where models are being used.
Yeah, I suppose you could justify in story terms why there are models being used. Suggestion of an artificialness of it, an artifice to it. But at the same time, it did kind of pull me out of the film and story a bit.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I don't know if that's just because I'm so used to very sleek CGI now, but there were definitely certain sequences and certain bits of it. And again, comparing it to The Matrix, which came out just 1 year later.
Mm. Which is very similar in theme.
Very similar in theme. But the feel and look of it, it still looks pretty damn good now.
Yes, yeah.
Still holds up pretty good now. Whereas, just look at the Matrix. We went, not so much perhaps some of the bits of the plot, but certainly the look of the Matrix still looks quite slick and modern now. Mm. Whereas Dark City really looks old.
Yeah.
I thought, when watching it, I was like, what's this, like early 90s? I was genuinely surprised, 1998. But I suppose that's what, 13 years ago now?
Yeah, and in terms of budget, it was made on something like...
Yeah, small budget.
It was quite 27 million?
£27, man.
£27.
That's incredible.
£27. Yeah, it was all filmed on Richard O'Brien's kitchen table.
Yeah.
They had to miniaturise the actors.
The great thing is just Richard O'Brien looks and dresses like that anyway.
Exactly.
Yeah, bald head, grey skin, dark long coat with a fedora hat.
Brought his own clothes.
Yeah, I mean, the influences are... This is an interesting bit. I was thinking of film. Yeah, the film is a lot about identity, perception that the real world isn't quite as what you think it is, you know, that there is a hidden world or a hidden layer and that you can't see, and then you are gradually sort of exposed to it. There was definitely something in the water back in the late 90s, because there were so many films like that. And I just sort of made a list off the top of my head films from that time.
He's got a book out.
I've got a book. You've got The Matrix.
Yeah.
You've got Fight Club, which has, not to give the
spoiler
away, but The Truman Show.
Truman Show, yeah.
Open Your Eyes, which of course remade
Vanilla Sky. Yeah.
Memento, Existence.
Existence is paused.
So many films at that time just had that kind of sense of that there is a hidden reality, that there is more to characters than we can, than you can see, or more to people than you can see. Kind of falling down the rabbit hole to sort of see this strange world that's always been there, that's actually had a huge influence on our world, which is never realised. I don't know what it was, millennial angst.
Yeah, I don't know. It's interesting. Like you say, there are quite a few films that share that thing. I noticed when I was reading around again that this film is particularly based on an idea called Last Thursdayism. I don't know if you read about that.
Yes.
The idea that there is nothing in the world we know that could prove it existed beyond some point in the past.
Yeah, I mean, it's a classic kind of slightly pissed up a student who's done two lectures of philosophy, little kind of, I'm going to blow your mind. What about, how do we know the past? How do we know the past has happened? Yeah, and all that kind of stuff. The idea that we could just be given false past and we would have no way of being able to tell whether that it's true or not. That the world could have been created last Thursday and we have no real evidence to suggest otherwise.
No, except that it's quite unlikely.
Yeah, but I suppose it's true. Yeah, well, that argument says there is. Let's get into a really deep philosophical debate now, Lewis.
I don't think we're not really drunk enough for that, are we?
No, that's true. It's got to be 3 a.m. We've got to be drinking loads of red wine. And we've got one of us has got to say, yeah, but how can you know anything's really real?
And also, we need at least one or two women around. We need to impress.
Yeah, I don't know. There was never any real women around, were there? Those conversations. A distinct lack of... That's why I was up having those conversations at 3 a.m.
Could have been doing something much better.
Anyway, so but there was that time, that kind of sense of unreality. Just weird. It really struck me as I wrote. All those films came up. I don't know. You can't really tell when you're living in that. When you're in the time, you can't see kind of themes and things like that. I wonder what it is right now. What keeps on coming up now?
Zombies.
Yeah, there is that. Yeah, there's lots of zombie films at the moment. That's just because one was popular. So everyone's just copying each other. But, going back to The Matrix, which I now will talk about.
Oh, whatever.
It's very interesting how similar these films are. Now, there's only a year's gap between them. So they were more or less made at the same time. Especially as I imagine The Matrix took a lot longer to make than Dark City. Yes. That's just a hunch, but I suspect.
Yeah, probably.
With all the bullet time and stuff like that, I imagine it took a while. And they were being made in totally different ends of the...
Dark City was made in...
Oh, that's true. No, tell a lie. There was a couple of bits of The Matrix used one or two of Dark City sets.
Did it really?
Yeah, so I mean, I don't know how much of it, but he used one or two. I imagine like some of the roads or alleyways or something.
I thought they filmed The Matrix in Canada though, didn't they?
No, it was in Australia or New Zealand.
It was in Australia. Okay.
I think they did
Dark City in Australia.
Yeah. So yeah, no, it definitely was. That's what that's I mean, not talking about The Matrix too much, but in The Matrix, the main city, again, is slightly nondescript, but in a very modern way.
Yes, yeah.
And that's because Australian cities are pretty nondescript. Because there's just, glass office blocks.
Ian's shrugging. I don't know if you can see this back home. But.
Well, no, hopefully not. Christ, I hope they can't see us. That's a bit weird. Are you filming this? Then you just secretly give it out to subscribers. Oh, my God.
What do you think?
Can you secretly control reality? Right, I hope you weren't watching me when I was watching the bit with Melissa George.
Rewind.
And there's lots of similarities between The Matrix and Dark City. Both feature characters who are shown a hidden world.
Mm-hmm.
Both are then realise they have the power to change that kind of world and bring down the bad guys. Yeah, so both are quite unique and special. Just like lots of little bits, the idea of memories being false. Mm. In The Matrix, they're kind of given memories, aren't they?
Yeah,
they can ask for the memories to be changed. And that, again, comes up in Dark City about characters losing memories, being given new memories,
their
entire lives changing.
It's really interesting similarities.
Yeah.
I wonder if... I don't think there is any connection apart from the set that you mentioned, but it's quite interesting those, but then I suppose that does happen sometimes in film, like
definitely.
I remember we had two meteor movies coming out the same summer, and
there was a couple of earthquake ones as well at the same time,
and two ant films coming out at the same time.
That's true. There is something about that. Who knows? There is. You get, it's like the telephone was kind of, a couple of people invented the telephone roughly at the same time. Things, sometimes I guess there's something in the air, or you're commenting on popular culture. And I think at the end, and even to, even now, especially in Western societies, the busier they are, the bigger our cities become. Mm. I suppose the more isolated sometimes we feel, and separate to people, and that both The Matrix and Dark City kind of fed on that idea, and things like The Truman Show as well, that where you almost feel like, it's not quite right, I can't put my finger on it, but I feel slightly separate to everything here.
I suppose maybe it's tapping into a kind of a paranoia. Paranoia in society that something's not right and something's going a bit wrong.
Yeah,
I suppose you could say that's quite similar now. Things going wrong economically,
I don't think that ever goes away. I think every single human beings are always feel like that. it's really a modern malaise. I mean,
especially even in like the prosperity of the '50s in America, they're worried about people invading and aliens and
Every single generation thinks it's the most important one. Every single generation thinks it's probably going to be the last one.
Yeah.
There's always that sense of there's an apocalypse just around the corner.
Yeah, exactly.
Although with us, it almost certainly is. We almost certainly are going to be the last ones.
Oh, dear.
Or one of the last ones. Going to talk about the quiz, I think.
Let's do the quiz.
Talking about paranoia. I don't know why I'm not that paranoid about the quiz. But
should we do the jingle?
Quark.
It's time for the quiz.
I love the fact the quiz jingle changes every single time. Except the one thing that always is the same about it, it's always shit. Just you going quiz.
That's quite good.
Quiz. That's just saying the word quiz in a slightly fey voice.
Quiz. Right, okay.
Right, shuffling papers. Okay.
Okay, you go first.
Oh. All right. Okay. So, Ian Richardson.
Ian Richardson. Mr. Book.
The leader of the bad guys. Is famous, probably most famous in Britain, for appearing in the television drama The House of Cards.
Oh, yes.
Playing Prime Minister. Do you know his name?
Oh, no. Oh, I don't know his name.
You don't know his name? I bet you do when I say it.
Is it Mr. Card?
No, it's House Card. Yeah, do you know?
No, I don't.
No idea at all?
No idea. Okay. Sorry.
Moving on to...
Oh, it's a shame, I should know that.
Okay. Moving on to my next... Actually, all my questions are quite hard. Apologies. All my questions are a little bit tricky.
Well, mine are quite hard this week as well.
I read this on Internet Movie Database, so you may have seen this as well.
Oh, fingers crossed.
What's unique about the shot lengths in this film?
Ah, now, this is something I actually want to talk about. I'm going to do a U. I'm going to talk about it in a minute.
Okay. But you're going to answer the question.
But I know the shot lengths are one of the shortest average shot length of any film at 1.8 seconds per shot, which is almost basically blink and it changes.
Yeah, that's very true.
Yeah.
And you're going to do quite well because you've already answered my ask. I unfortunately didn't come up with four questions. I struggled a little bit with questions this time. But and the obvious ones I think you probably would have gone for. Because you're obvious. What is the name? And you've already answered this, but I'll say it again. What is the name of the philosophy underpinning the film?
Oh, Last Thursdayism. Yeah. Yes.
And for an extra... I don't know, I'm going to give you a bonus point, but who cares? For an extra bonus point, the name of the philosopher who introduced it.
Oh, I don't know.
I should have asked you that. You've already said Last Thursdayism. Okay, do you want to ask me your questions or do you...
I'll do mine. Okay, mine are quite hard as well this week. They're quite off topic as well.
Right, okay, good.
I thought I'd do a U.
I don't know if you're detecting this, listeners. There's a certain air of...
this is rebellion.
I think what we did, we listened to one of our other podcasts before we'd record this one, and we were just so shocked at how terrible we came across and how poor we are. We're taking out our anger on each other. We're arguing with each other because we're just like, oh, God, I was an idiot in that last podcast.
No, this is good. This is a much better podcast. Right, okay. Number one. So Richard O'Brien, God bless him.
Yep.
He famously presented the Crystal Maze, as we discussed.
He certainly did, yes.
How many series of the Crystal Maze did Richard O'Brien present?
Let's say five.
Okay. Question number two. Jennifer Connelly went on to star in another dark film in 2005. What was it called?
Another dark film? Mm. Any other clue other than that?
No, it's got dark in the title. Come on, I need to hurry.
Is it just dark? Is it dark or it's a variation on dark?
It's just dark something.
Okay, let's call it Dark Room.
Okay, and question number three.
Nonsense, listeners. This really is. It's kind of... There's hard and there's impossible.
Look, if you were a film buff, you'd know about this. If you actually watch more films instead of just...
Looking at Melissa George over and over again.
Okay, question number three. The film is similar to The City of Lost Children in theme. Have you ever seen The City of Lost Children?
No.
but it's like Dark City.
Right, okay.
Which is directed by Jean-Pierre Jeunet.
Yes.
Name another film directed by Jean-Pierre Jeunet. He's French.
No. I got that. annoying. Because
name a French film.
The only one I can think of, and there is a connection there, but I can't think of what. I don't think it is this, but there is a connection in some way. But what's it called? Amelie. I'm stumbling over my words. It's Amelia. Yeah, is that right?
I'll give you that.
Okay.
Okay, so what are your answers?
Okay, well, you got, obviously, the last Thursdayism question right. It was Bertrand Russell.
Bertie Russell.
Came up with the concept. He was kind of, but he was actually sort of mocking. He gave it that name as a sort of mocking of another, he gave it that name, but the concept had come up about 50 years earlier in the mid-19th century, and he sort of was mocking it slightly for its pretentiousness. The name of Ian Richardson's Prime Minister in the House of Cards is Francis Urquhart.
Oh, no, I wouldn't have got that.
And finally, what's unique about the shot lengths in the film, you're right, the average length was 1.8 seconds, which means there was a cut every 2 seconds, roughly. It's crazy.
It's mad, isn't it? Anyway, yeah, so you're...
So you get, what was that?
Two points. Oh, that's all right. Two. Okay, so how many series of the Crystal Maze did Richard O'Brien present? You said...
Five.
Answer was four.
Oh, no!
Close.
That was a hard question.
That was a hard question. He presented four series. Ed Tudor Pole.
I know, yeah. Two. I couldn't remember how. I know there was about six or seven, but I couldn't remember.
Yes. Yeah. Jennifer Connelly went on to star in Dark Water.
Don't remember that.
Thriller, which I haven't seen.
Oh, yes, it is coming to... Yeah, I do vaguely remember it now. There was some dark water in it, right?
Yeah, that's yep. right.
Yeah, I remember that.
And some light water. And Tim Roth. The film is similar to The City of Lost Children by Jean-Pierre Junot.
Yep.
Who also directed Amelie.
I'll give you that one. Yeah, I knew. I didn't think it was. What was the other one? What's the one about cannibals?
Delicatessen.
Is that the same?
Yes.
Yeah, that was the other one I was going to say.
He also directed Micmac. And... Alien Resurrection.
Don't do that.
Oh, we're not allowed to do national stereotypes.
We had to destroy the last podcast.
Oh, yeah.
Unbelievably racist. This is terrible. So, we've touched a little bit on the strengths and weaknesses of the film. The strengths of the film is the sense of unreality. I did think one of the weaknesses, though, was it was... cheesy. Bits of it were quite cheesy. It did suffer from that characters having to say some really... unfortunately, it does happen a lot in science fiction, of characters having to say some pretty shocking lines.
Yeah.
Towards the end of the film, again, no spoiler here, but Rufus Sewell's character, John Murdoch, says something about, yes, you're looking for what it means to be human in our heads. You were looking in the wrong place. And actually, in my notes, I said, please don't say it. Don't point at your heart. Please don't point at your heart. Please don't point at your heart. Because I just could... It seemed to be like, it's right here. He luckily didn't.
He
just left that... He just left that hanging. But it was that kind of... He sort of raised an eyebrow. And Richard O'Brien was like, that's a little bit... And there was a couple of other bits where I actually said the line before they said it. Because it was just so...
Yeah, I guess. I totally agree with you on that. It's something that when I originally watched it, I didn't really recall that at all. But when I watched it again a few days ago, I was like, oh, God, yeah, some of these bits are really cheesy, aren't they?
Yeah.
Particularly, I think just overall as well, the plot, there are some massive holes in the plot.
Yeah.
You could drive a bulldozer through some of those holes.
Yeah.
I mean, it's it doesn't actually hang together well in that kind of sense. It's very much, I feel... a film that's... a lot of it is style over substance.
Yeah.
But when the style's this good, I don't think that's really a problem.
But maybe you're noticing it a little bit more. One, because you're not watching it at 2 a.m. or whatever it was. But also perhaps back then, the style could carry... You know, it's starting to look perhaps a touch dated as time goes on. So perhaps that style is fading away. So now you're kind of seeing weaknesses of the rest of the film. Bless her. I mean, she's a lovely looking lady, but Jennifer Connelly, this is not brilliant. And she spends a lot of... She doesn't have we were talking earlier about what, you know, most characters give them quite a lot to do. She doesn't have much to do beyond just say, John. John?
Yeah.
John.
She's just kind of a blank, whiny woman.
Yeah,
she
does
kind of very...
meander around it a lot, just going, John?
I agree. I read somewhere, I think even her bio on Wikipedia or something, it was saying that, you know, she was critically praised for her role in this movie, and I was like, really? I don't know, but I think of all the major characters in the film, she comes off the weakest.
But then again, she may be doing that on purpose.
Yeah.
Going back to the Matrix, it's the old Keanu Reeves debate of is he just good in the Matrix because he just plays a baffled, slightly awkward, slightly wooden guy, which suits the film perfectly. Yeah. So it's perfect casting.
Yeah.
Is he actually? Yeah. Well, no, we know with Keanu Reeves, he's not better than that. It was just perfect casting. But if you that was the only Keanu Reeves film you ever saw, you were like, wow, he's an amazing actor. Yeah, he fits it perfectly. He's totally doing everything right in this film. He's just being used really well.
Yeah, especially you've got that. I remember you talked about Existence earlier as well.
Mm.
And I remember watching that film for the first time, kind of thinking, oh, the acting's terrible in this. They're just really awkward and wooden. And then you realise, oh, gee, no.
And you could say perhaps, I mean, perhaps the one good thing about the film is in favour, even if they're not meant as weaknesses, the weakness is that perhaps it's looking slightly dated, that characters are perhaps occasionally wooden or a little bit awkward, does actually suit the general theme of the film anyway. So you could actually say it's all on purpose. Possibly it is all on purpose. Perhaps it's the greatest film ever, but I suspect not.
Yeah, no, that's true.
I suspect it's just a happy coincidence.
The other thing that I saw as a weakness was the shot length. I talked about, you brought it up in the trivia quiz.
Mm.
It's just ridiculous. It's like machine gun. It's like machine gun editing. There is, and I remember watching it the second time thinking, my God, just slow down, linger on something. Just linger. There's no pathos because there's no, for the whole, probably the most half, at least the first half of the film, it's just desperately kind of flick, click, click, change. And you're just like, I just want to rest.
Yeah, definitely, yeah.
The trouble is all these rapid shot changes, particularly when there's not much going on, is that it removes the pathos from the scene.
Yeah.
It's
almost, it's a lack of confidence in the material sometimes. Yeah. It's almost like, we've got to jazz this up.
Exactly. Yeah,
we can't just have two characters just having a bit of exposition. We've got to cut around it constantly to try and make this visually interesting. But when you've got the sets that you have and the, I don't think you really need to do that.
No. With a bit more kind of subtle editing, I think this could have been a much better film.
Now, we both watched the original cut of this, the one that was released in the cinema. There has since been a director's cut, which is a little bit longer. I hear that they've added sequences. They take away the opening voiceover as well.
Yes.
That would be interesting to see whether that's perhaps slightly better paced.
Mm. If they've added in material, I don't know how much material they've added in or where they've edited it in, but if they've kind of extended some of the kind of shots, then I think that would be definitely a good thing.
Yeah.
Alex Proyas, he came from music videos.
Yeah.
And I think that's really quite evident in the way this film's shot. Because it is that fast-paced editing that you would kind of put with music videos, but really isn't appropriate for like an hour and a half feature film.
He's the McGee of his time.
Yeah.
Funny enough, talking about McGee, there is, along with the kind of, I suppose, Batman, it's very much a comic book influence as well.
Yeah.
Of everything from those kind of little old newspaper strips with detectives and things like that to the kind of those 1940s and 50s kind of action adventure comics as well. Very comic book film. Added with the look of it as well.
Yeah.
I
love the references to Shell Beach. I think are really great. There's some really nice touches in that. There's some really beautiful visuals. Really, really.
Yeah,
nice.
Some moments, some great shots.
Yeah.
I think, and perhaps this does go in its favour. We see the lair of the bad guys, the main villains, and that does look different to the main city.
Yes,
That looks a lot more modern, a lot more slick, which perhaps does suggest that they're doing the city on purpose to look slightly artificial because it is sort of an artificial place.
Yeah, I've listened to some of the DVD extras, and it said that their intention was to try and the strangers. This is the scary trench coated people.
Yes,
want to have a
just right at the end of the podcast, we give them a name which would have really been easy to say than scary trench coat people, the actual name they're called in the film. But yes, the strangers.
But yeah, Alex Proyas, he's the director, said he wanted to create a timeless city, and I think he's kind of achieved
that. Definitely, yeah.
I think that's about it. Is there anything else you wanted to
I suppose the only other kind of other little bit I wanted to mention was really, we've not really talked about it much, Kiefer Sutherland's performance in it. It's just I know we talked about him doing the funny voice for his doctor.
Yes.
But I didn't recognise him to begin with.
No, I didn't either.
It's very out of character, very unusual. I suppose what I always think now, especially since 24, he's just such a, he's just so, his name's connected to either kind of Lost Boys, where he's kind of this
Lost Boys,
kind of young, thrusting, you know, guy, or in 24, where he's a grizzled action hero.
Yeah.
To see him playing this kind of nerdy, awkward, weird, slightly foreign but not quite foreign doctor.
Yeah.
Very odd.
It's interesting. It's like he, in that kind of middle bit of his career, he was trying out different roles. I wonder what other films he was in around that time. Interesting to kind of dig out a few Kiefer Sutherland classics.
Why don't you have a look on Internet Movie Database? That's your homework for this week. If you could write it down, send it up to us, that would be great.
He was probably looking for an Oscar or something. he's trying to find his Oscar.
I don't think,
not in this film.
No. As enjoyable as it is.
He does have a fantastic kind of baby walker contraption at the end, which I won't talk about for fear of giving it away. But
there is
a great appearance.
Okay, I'm not sure. One last thing. Really, I just want to say it struck me, and again, we're being very coy. You probably noticed at home that we're about giving too much of the plot away, but the strangers are trying to survive. As I say, they're trying to survive. And by running things and by watching us and observing us, often I thought, well, really, if you want to survive, perhaps get some girls in, because all of you are played by boys and by men. That's really surprising. This huge experiment they're running to work out how to survive. Maybe just have some babies.
A woman,
Melissa, do you want?
Oh dear, well, on that slightly seedy note, maybe maybe we should say whether we recommend it or not.
I would recommend it, especially if you're if you like science fiction. It's an interesting, unusually shot film. Certainly if you like The Crow, or perhaps things like Batman or The Matrix, I think it would definitely worth watching for that.
Yeah, definitely. If you're a sci-fi fan, definitely worth watching. Definitely recommended it. Definitely. I think as long as you kind of look past the slightly wonky models.
And the thing with me is I'm totally used to doing that. I watch so much old British kind of science fiction and TV shows and old TV shows. I'm almost got this weird filter that I can just quickly throw up.
Throw up.
Well, you know, it's like suddenly, like, yeah, it's almost like raise my shield. Yeah, I just have to raise the filter and I can just see it through the eyes of a.
See, I thought you actually meant throw up as in vomit.
Yes, yeah, so I'm immediately sick.
Immediately sick.
It disorientates me enough that I can then see through the shoddy effects of a.
Whenever of a, I see a model, British, I just vomit.
1970s obscure science fiction drama.
Yeah. Well, haven't you got Quatermass in the Pit or something?
Yeah, that holds up quite well, though. The very first Quatermass, it's like it's made in the 1900s or something. It's incredible. Let's finish our podcast on a totally random note. But I would say I've got the Quatermass and the Quatermass experiment. The second Quatermass, which name escapes me now, Quatermass 2, I think it's called. I think it's called that. And then the third one, which is Quatermass in the Pit, which were 1950s British science fiction dramas. Probably the first science fiction on British television, more or less. The first one was, about 52. So really very early on in television. You know, TV had only come back 5 years before, after the war. By the last one, which is done in 1959, it's incredible how much television has developed in like 5 years, or no, about 7 years. It's like there's a 20-year gap, not 7-year gap. It's absolutely amazing. It looks so much better, so much clearer and crisper, and better shot, and moves faster. It feels very modern, whereas that 1952 one, although interesting, it's everyone talks. Hello, everyone talks like the Queen. It's incredible.
I suppose you could say the same about the Dark City and the Matrix. You know, being just a year apart, but What a revolution the Matrix launched into.
It really was. And I guess perhaps that's why it had such a big impact on us, because there was nothing that looked like it before. No. It really, quite clearly, very similar themes and very similar ideas, but the look was so out there and so different. And Dark City has a very unique look. And I suppose perhaps one day the look of the Matrix will age, and perhaps Dark City will end up standing up better because it has a very unique aesthetic to it.
Yeah, interesting.
And there you go.
And there we go. So yes, watch Dark City. It's great.
It's good. See you next time. We held it together right to the end. Damn it. Bye, listeners.
Bye.